lock stitch. Now practice sewing straight lines of lock stitch. Feed the cloth steadily through and, like magic, a line of stitching appears. The important thing is to let the machine do the work. You don't need to push or pull the cloth, simply keep it in line. Try stitching a tube of cloth, such as that used for an arm piece. Scrunch up the cloth so that you can sew its entire length. The rub pat barrier in machine sewing is balancing the speed you sew at, which affects the speed of the cloth moving, with the accuracy of the stitching. But don't worry. If you go off course, you can use the seam ripper to clear that line of stitching and start again. 3. Get cloth that really excites you to make the shirt. The crazier the better, if that's what gets you going. Non-stretchy cotton is easiest, though. Very thin cloth will be harder to handle as it may stretch out of shape as you sew. Once you have practiced machine stitching long enough that you can do fairly straight lines, it's time to begin assembling the shirt. Iron each piece as you assemble it. Have the iron hot and ready to use as you go. You'll need it to get rid of wrinkles and also to make hems and folded bits. Start with making the two front panels. Both will need foldovers at the point they will meet. You'll see how from the shirt you disassembled. You can tack pieces together very quickly by hand sewing, or you can use pins. Tacking takes longer, but it is a little easier then to machine sew. So, pin or tack the edges that need sewing to hold the cloth in place. Sew the front and the back pieces to the shoulder yoke. Next, do the buttonholes. Hand sew these, or use the buttonhole stitching attachment on the machine. Next, do the armholes. Sides stitched to the back, sleeves, cuffs, and collar. 4. The hard part as you go along is not giving up because your shirt doesn't look like a real one. Remember, it hasn't been pressed yet. That can make a huge difference to what it looks like. 5. As soon as it is ready, press it and wear it. You might even stitch your own designer label above the pocket that reads, "I made it myself." After a shirt, Micromaster John Paul Flintoff made a pair of jeans. I've seen them, and you couldn't tell they weren't made by a top designer. Micromaster your life. Permission to be interested. Start small, start humble. As children, we all started by learning how to do a few small things well, using cutlery, tying our shoelaces, riding a bicycle. Can this essentially low-key approach be leveraged into a way to improve almost everything about your life? I think it can. This book makes the alluring promise of revealing a hidden path to happiness. It's hidden because we hide it from ourselves. We hide that which is too difficult, complex, expensive, time-consuming. The hidden is all we deny ourselves permission to be interested in. Everything starts with interest. If we aren't interested, we don't notice and we don't learn. Happy people have interests and are interesting, and showing severe lack of interest is a sign of depression. Yet no one gives us permission to be interested. That's right. The culture we live in tantalizes through images and yet tacitly withdraws any genuine involvement. The real world is presented as professional, there to be admired but not touched. So the hidden path to success is relearning how to give yourself permission to be interested and engaged in anything. This world is a complex place, good at shutting people out, excluding them, making people exclude themselves. Though it might be necessary, say, to exclude a person with dirty hands from an operating theatre, much of life is not like this. In most of our lives, we could all be a lot more interested and a lot more involved. We don't do it, usually, because the entry costs in terms of energy, commitment, money, kit, knowledge, and so on, are seen as too high. And we get into the habit. We imagine things. A man who built a car for £250 found that no one asked him how many hours it took or how difficult it was to do. They all commented how hard it was going to be to get it licensed for the road. Actually, that was the easy part. DVLA officials are bored and love giving something new a chance to be used. But people are used to thinking that red tape is stopping them. And it's a lot easier to watch the latest box set instead of actually doing something. Micromastery, as a way of looking at the world, gives you unlimited permission to be interested, unlimited permission to get involved. Welcome to the limitless world. The Tiger and the Cage. Imagine a tiger locked in a cage, a roaring tiger eager to escape. That roaring tiger is all the bundled energy and enthusiasm you have, just waiting to be unleashed upon the world. Doesn't it feel like that sometimes? That if only you could find the right key to the cage, all your indecision, indolence, and lack of gumption would disappear, and that roaring tiger would be unstoppable. The cage has two doors, both locked. One door is big and inviting, with a single large keyhole. The other, small, and a tight squeeze with three locks. The floor of the cage is littered with keys, and the poor tiger, with his clumsy old paws, has a hard enough time just lifting a key and fitting it in the lock. Some are big keys and some are little keys. The big keys seem the obvious ones, even though they are much heavier, harder to find and harder to handle. After a huge amount of effort, the tiger finds a big key and unlocks the big door. The big door leads to a place full of food. It seems wonderfully free at first. He gorges on all the food and grows awfully big and fat and clumsy. But then he slowly discovers he has simply entered a larger cage. Once he starts looking, he finds there is an exit, no key required, but it is very small and low, and he can't fit through it. Moreover, now he finds that all the fine food is both sickening and addictive. He can't lose weight, and his former boundless energy begins to wane. He grows tired and old, and even scared of the world outside. Too late, he realizes that the job, career, specialization is merely a means to an end, to being able to interact with the world with energy and enthusiasm. But he thought it was an end in itself, and by his thinking that, it became another cage. The smaller, less distinguished door requires three different keys, but there are many on the ground. Any three will do. Quickly, the tiger learns, all you have to do is find and insert one, and then another, and another. It's easy. Soon the little door is unlocked, into a place with just enough meager food to keep him looking and learning. He, too, finds that he is in another cage, but also quickly finds the small exit. Still slim and fit, he bounds through it. And through this exit lies the whole abundant world. Truly free, the tiger's energy and enthusiasm never wanes. He is open, on. He has permission to be interested in everything. He can even do the job, career, and specialization because he knows that it's not the answer to everything. He has permission to be interested in the abundant world. The object in life is not mastery over one subject, attractive though that is. There are many masters of one thing, from sport to art to business, who live wasted and unhappy lives. The object is to use mastery to get out of the cage and live the fullest life you can. That means becoming more polymathic, more open, more alive. You get out of the cage by using micromasteries to give yourself permission to be interested and involved in anything you want, and to be able to withhold and extend interest and switch interest with fluency and ease. You've always felt like this. Inside you there is a caged tiger of energy and enthusiasm just waiting to burst out. Release that tiger! Your many selves. Your passport, ID cards, driving license, and bank accounts all have the same name on them. You are doomed to be that one person. Our whole culture underpins this notion, yet it is blatantly untrue. You are not one. You are many. The insights of multiple personality psychology provide a useful metaphor for us all. We house many different selves. Just a moment's reflection will reveal that. One of ourselves might like smoking, while the rest hate it. You might have a self who is keen on sport, yet there is another who loves to curl up with a book and abhors the idea of moving even to get a drink of water. One self might be interested in poetry and art, another might revel in business and making money, and all these selves jostle and rapidly succeed each other throughout the day. If you are uncomfortable with the idea of multiple selves at this point, think of them as strands of self. But they are strands with considerable autonomy, just as a single strand of a rope is similar to but more limited than the rope itself. Who hasn't felt exasperation at hearing they're either introverted or extroverted? Most of us can be both, depending on the situation and the self in charge. Sometimes you can start in one self and be jerked into another, and the results can be dramatic. Suddenly you're in the groove and really humming. Some of yourselves may be good at driving and some not. It can be as simple as that when it comes to having a prang on the road. The first step is simply to accept the idea you are many, not one. Then simply observe these different selves in action, how often they crop up, and what they're good and not so good at. Identify your many selves through micromastery. Micromastery works as the visible experiential evidence of the multiple strands of self. Each micromastery we feel drawn to learn represents a self. I felt a need to practice martial arts, just as I did with drawing, long-distance walking, writing, and cooking. They are all strands of my rope. But the self isn't just a series of mundane skills. We have to empathize with, be interested in, and care for others. We have to build and sometimes destroy. A carpenter and a blacksmith must have a violent self in order to wield the tools they use at work. A gardener must have a self that is patient and caring. All these selves can be represented by micromasteries too, or be an integral part of one. What gives you pleasure? Observe your little routines. Some may have developed already into full-blown interests, while others might be nascent, waiting to be activated. Observe yourself as you undertake different activities. Look for the things you do and don't enjoy that seem to crop up while doing those things. Different selves have different likes. One might enjoy mixing with all kinds of people, picking up new ideas for businesses. Another, who may surface after a few hours of fiction writing, is a recluse who doesn't even want to leave the apartment. If recluse is forced outside and made to do heavy exercise, like running up a hillside, he may flip into mountain man, a self who likes nothing better than grueling physical exertion. All change begins with observation, which must be done without judgment. It cannot be repeated too many times that controlling these selves starts with this, rather than a desire to change. Once you've observed them, assign each self a micromastery, if it hasn't got one already. If you have a controlling, tidying, finishing self, assign it a task like washing up, cleaning shoes, ironing, something satisfying and limited. Maybe turn shoe shining into a micromastery. Then, should you need to become more controlling and finishing, just clean some shoes to get into that frame of mind. The recent boom in adult colouring books is fascinating. Colouring offers a way to activate that detail-loving, manually skilled side of the brain we are denied using in so many keyboard-based jobs. The colouring micromastery is being used to access a different self, one that is more relaxed and has more fun. Kung Fu Panda, the first and best movie in the franchise, has the wonderful sequence where Shifu, voiced by Dustin Hoffman, is angrily intoning, "Inner peace. Inner peace. Inner peace." The message is clear. We can't command our emotional state through mere words or wishful thinking. The multiple self model makes it obvious why. We need to enter a different self, not calm down. When we flip into a new self, we calm down immediately. Ever gone out and chopped wood when you're angry? Flipping to a physical self works wonders. Who hasn't seen the immediate effect good news can have? I once was in bed with flu and received news I had got a new job. I leapt out of bed and was cured immediately. Another self had taken over. I'm not suggesting all illness can disappear so easily, but being in the wrong self for certain situations exacerbates stresses that can lead to illness. Once you embrace, rather than fight against, the multiple self model, you actively look for ways to switch, and you can use a micromastery to do so. When you can flip to the best self for the job, you will find tasks so much easier. For example, because I was overawed by the martial arts environment in Japan, I was in student mode a lot of the time. But actually, in order to do something physical, it was far better to be in a tough physical guy frame of mind. Now, when I have to do a physical learning task, I practice skill and balancing warm-up exercises, sometimes to exhaustion, anything that leads away from the more inner-directed self used in writing. Conversely, I use the reflective task of writing about the best moment of the previous day as a way of entering my writing self. Micromaster the harmonica. Nick Reynolds is the son of great train robber Bruce Reynolds, who, after committing the biggest robbery of the time in 1963, eventually gave himself up and went to prison for 12 years. Nick grew up without a father present, and made an early vow never to follow the same path and end up behind bars. He saw what a waste that was of any person's potential. He saw the Royal Navy as both an honourable profession and a way to lead an exciting but worthwhile existence. Soon after signing up, he found himself fighting in the Falklands, where he served on battleships under constant attack from the Argentine Air Force. Though he might have imagined he had a single self, the professional sailor, it became apparent that in periods of downtime, other selves came to the fore, and they demanded release. Nick found himself being more rebellious, bucking against the routines of the Navy. The rebel self can take pleasure in spoiling all your other selves' best efforts. But rebel selves can be turned towards either destructive or creative micromasteries. If we are lucky, art is where we go when we rebel against the tedious normality of everyday life, and artistic micromasteries have rehabilitated many people. Nick was musical but didn't have the inclination or time to learn a complicated instrument, so he picked one of the easiest, the harmonica. Also, though he hadn't been to art school, he could still draw, as everyone can. So he kept himself busy in the Navy by playing the harmonica and drawing, both skills which, as they developed, people remarked upon. He realized gradually that the Navy was a kind of trap for a creative soul. He needed more freedom to explore the gifts he developed. As an artist, he started drawing and then casting in bronze the heads of famous criminals that his father had known. He also cast the head of any famous criminal who died, thus reviving the ancient art of making death masks. Nick wanted to use this as a way of drawing attention to the wrong choices criminals made, though many people saw it as the opposite, as aggrandizing the criminal fraternity. Through his art, Nick managed to attend many parties given by the bohemian creative types living in London. At one such party, he deployed his other micromastery, playing the harmonica, and people liked it. When the pop group Alabama 3 needed a harmonica player, they thought of Nick, bringing him into the band and giving him a second string to add to his career as an artist. Each activity helped the other. Through his work in the music business, he was able to get more commissions for his sculptures. A moment of recognition was when an Alabama 3 music track was chosen as the theme for the hit TV series The Sopranos. Honour thyselves. No one is born a lawyer, doctor, plumber, or baker. We braid our multiple selves into one fairly convincing rope and then hope the world won't notice the joins. We can do this by trying to kill various strands, various selves we have. We can do it by ignoring their many pleas for recognition. We can do it by compartmentalizing our lives. Or we can do it by trying to integrate as best we can the warring selves into one coherent whole. Traditional wisdom the world over suggests that trying to integrate our various personalities into one that is aligned with a general purpose, a path, is best. There is little to disagree with here. The only problem is, how do you identify your many different selves in the first place? And how do you keep tabs on them? I think that we need to honour and recognise each self as part of us. You can't just sweep one bit of you under the mat and hope it'll stay hidden. An author may go through phases where the writer self takes control. This self revels in spending long hours bashing away at the keyboard. It resents having to get exercise and talk to others, and particularly hates email. After a while, all the other selves begin to resent writer self's draconian rule. One day, writer self will flip. There is usually some catalyst, a sunny day, a forced trip or journey, even a new hairstyle could do it. Then, bang, another personality takes over. It could be exercise and adventure self, or accountant self, who is generally despised until bills need paying, or mariner self, who wants only to set sail across the high seas. Crushing your various selves works temporarily. Then they come back and start fighting for position again. But if they have a micromastery associated with them, you can start to control them. Think of them as an unruly family fighting for attention. Until they've been recognized and honored, they are not so easy to deal with. Your various selves may surprise you. They may appear trivial to you, even superficial. You might have a self that revels in fashion and coiffure, though you really believe these things are beneath you. You may have a self that loves making things, simple things like jigsaws or model aircraft. After all, both David Beckham and Norman Mailer honour a Lego-building self. Punk Micromastery. The punk bands of the late 1970s and early 80s were famous for one thing. They sang and played really, really badly. They didn't, however, wait for permission. They worked around their limitations, writing simple songs that didn't need great skill to play. Yet many of those songs by The Clash and others are still great songs, classics, created by unskilled musicians. The punk mentality extended into writing. Mark Perry, aided by school friends Steve Micallef and Danny Baker, started their own fanzine dedicated to music called Sniffin' Glue. Sold outside gigs, it became a hit and a huge influence in the world of music journalism. Danny Baker went on to become a music journalist and TV presenter. Micallef obtained a trade union scholarship to Oxford University based on the quality of his writing, and Mark Perry started the band ATV. They wanted to publish a magazine, so they got writing and photocopying and did it, even though none of them had any training or experience. In fact, Micallef, who after Oxford became a performance poet, claimed he hadn't read an entire book until he was 15. Reach for the Sky by Douglas Bader was that book. The punk mentality insists, why not try it? Instead of waiting around for the ideal moment, find a simplified version, a micromastery. Instead of learning to play the guitar, learn one song, play it a lot, experiment with it. It's not uncommon to meet someone with a PhD doing a job that doesn't require one. Journalism, for example. We see all kinds of qualification inflation going on. Why? Because people are too scared to just go out and do stuff. You don't need to go to school for 20 years to write for a newspaper or magazine. Actually, it'll probably make you a worse writer. Though I am a fan of limited, specific courses that help you learn something, lengthy academic courses can simply be a great training ground for more lengthy academic courses. The punk mentality came with a fierce rejection of the contemporary music scene. There was an urge to be different from the pampered and exclusive rock and soul music of the time. So while the Sex Pistols dreamed of being rock stars and even covered old rock and roll standards, they were rough and homemade in every sense. Escaping the ordinary means taking a different path from everyone else. It means using DIY techniques to achieve what you want right now, rather than waiting for years. Micromastery shares the same urgency. The world threatens us with its rules and exclusions. Break through them and do your own thing. Pick a micromastery and go for it. Instead of spending a fortune on a Chinese language course you'll probably give up, you can micromaster right now a simple set of greetings. Master all of them so you can greet everyone from an emperor to a small child. You'll have something permanent that you can also use as a springboard to learn much more. Give yourself permission to be interested and involved by invoking the spirit of punk. Micromastery versus global pessimism. Pessimism is showing a lurking preference for the negative and showering it with one's valuable store of interest energy. Pessimism is a cheat. It takes our attention, but denies us the chance to be involved. Not worth it, the pessimist concludes. Of course there is bad stuff out there. But send your interest and involvement towards the light, the positive, the things that you know work. The optimist might join Médecins Sans Frontières as a doctor helping in disaster zones. The pessimist scans the internet and likes disaster news. Pessimism is to be found anywhere people say they can't improve, learn, move on, change, lead, follow. It thrives in the land of can't. There is informed pessimism, for example, when you've seen the weather forecast, and there is unnoticed inner pessimism. It is the latter which is the problem. People limit and self-sabotage. With very little evidence, they assume they'll be no good. So what if they are no good? The people who attended the tone-deaf singing course with me went on to sing on primetime TV and get paid for it. Though they were no good, they were now professionals. Inner pessimism thrives on self-limitation. I haven't got time. I'm only an amateur. It causes self-sabotage. I'm not up to it, so I won't go anymore. This has to be the biggest cause of failure. Not turning up because inner pessimism tells you that you aren't good enough. The global culture, and our national culture, has its own brand of pessimism. Consumer culture is inherently pessimistic. The underlying message is shopping and eating and getting new stuff is the limit of our ambition. Remember that ad for Gillette razors? The best a man can get? maybe not. Don't misunderstand me. There isn't some evil Dr. Ad man pulling the wires, some corporation intent on destroying the minds of ordinary people. Rather, it is the result of logically trying to extract as much money as you can out of people using every legal means available. Wall-to-wall advertising naturally depicts characters who are attenuated in their passions, or who prefer to buy something rather than do something, and the drip-feed effect of this distorts the norm. Our culture pimps and peddles this pessimism. It wants us to be passive consumers rather than superhuman producers. Look at those McDonald's ads. The world is portrayed as a crappy place where a Big Mac is the best you can aspire to. I'm loving it. Success culture is pessimistic too. And yet our culture is obsessed with success. People who don't succeed are deemed losers. Some people self-identify as beat or slacker, and they may even succeed in this role, though the original beatnik, Jack Kerouac, died an alcoholic at 49 with most of his books out of print. Only later was he reimagined as a success. The trivial version of success culture, its basic model, is winning the lottery. The aim is always the same. You never have to work again. I once watched a self-important woman announce that she was now the success she always dreamed she'd be because she'd won $80 million in a state lottery. But she was just the same person she was before she won. Money, though very nice to have, is merely a kind of tool. It's like saying, now I have a big digger, I am the success I have always dreamed of being. But what are you going to dig? And what are you going to do with that money? Buy a big house and a lot of cars? You're still a dork, with or without the trimmings. People fantasize about buying big houses, land, farms, but they very often end up getting someone else to manage it for them. As woodland officer at North York Moors National Park Authority Mark Antcliffe told me, you can't buy a lifestyle. People don't realize that the dream job actually requires a lot of hidden work rather than just cash to become the surface reality others see. It has been wisely asserted that life is less about doing what one likes and more about liking what one does. You can find out what you like through micromastery, then do it. Developing a micromastery costs very little, but measure this real success against the trivial success of winning the lottery. Naturally, I'd love the money too. The point is that it doesn't remove the need to find something to do. It's only virtue. Widening your permission to be interested is useless if you don't have the basic knowledge about how to micromaster your way into something you will like doing. Unlike the weird vibe that emanates from success culture, a combination of glorification and buried pessimism, most successful people are rather unexceptional and optimistic. They simply found what they liked doing and did a lot of it. Eventually, they also found a way to get paid doing it. The innate pessimism of success culture says that only successful people count, which goes hand in hand with the idea that only other people succeed. But if we step aside from notions of how hard it is to succeed and instead look at building and developing our interests, talents, and skills, we'll see that the only real success is in improving yourself. Everything else is just stuff happening. A person who has learned things, cared for another person, honed a skill, taught someone, developed a talent, turned up and done something, that person can view their life as a real success. Micromastery kicks the ass of pessimism every time. The whole premise is that everyone can try this. Everyone can be a micromaster of many things. The number of micromasteries is almost limitless. I've detailed over 30 in this book, but that is only skimming the surface. Every area of sport, work, art, craft has its own potential micromasteries. And they are all out there just waiting for you to try. Fancy learning an Icelandic saga by heart? It'll go down a storm when you visit Reykjavik. Well, get on and start now. Fancy learning how to wingsuit off a mountain? There are courses out there. Want to be a sushi king? A maker of slow gin? It's all waiting. You have permission to be interested in everything and anything, and you can pursue any micromastery you wish. This doesn't mean a lifetime commitment, just a short, sharp immersion, and you can stay for as long or as little as you desire. Pessimism can bury you for years. Then one day, you wake up and throw open the curtains and say, "Hey, this is an incredible world, jammed full of amazing opportunities to become better at things, become a better person." Micromastery rolls back the pessimism by giving you an edge, a real improvement. When you have micromastered something, no matter how down you get, it can't be taken away from you. It becomes part of your permanent and positive inheritance. You may be depressed and thinking, "My life is wasted." And then you remember, "Well, at least I can do that. At least I did that." And from these small beginnings, you can claw your way back up to a full realization of how abundant the opportunities are in life. The big, bigger, biggest picture. So, you learn these micromasteries, become more polymathic, happier, more successful, in the widest sense, of course. But what is the really important reason for all this? It has to be the growth of the individual, you, me, measured in the degree of integration of yourselves that you ultimately achieve. It's no good overdeveloping one self at the expense of the others. It might serve some organization, army, cause, or family. You might be a good worker bee, like those Japanese executives who die from overwork and dedication to their corporations. But that wasn't why you were put on this planet. We're not here for purely mundane, earthbound reasons. And any motivation that misses the human need to connect to the greater mysteries of life is ultimately going to shortchange you. To do this, you need to be a better person. More integrated, less trivial, more perceptive, more empathetic, more resilient, more energetic. A single self obsessed by stock prices, beauty products, or toy trains can't run your real life. You know you are a whole gamut of selves, and these need integrating to reach the next level of connection to the deeper realities of life. Our multiple selves compete and demand recognition, but they also attack and belittle each other. When I am my business self and see a painting or photograph, I often unthinkingly dismiss it. Yet if I was my artist self, I would admire it. Business self wants to put down any other selves. Take a moment and observe your different reactions to things. Take food. One self might like healthy food, but when the other self, who likes guiltier pleasures, is in the driving seat, this healthy food will be lampooned as inedible or boring. So not only do we lose energy and direction by switching selves, we also lose a lot more by attacking other selves. This is where attempts at integration begin. To integrate all these disparate selves into one useful operating organism is like herding cats. or can be. What is required is a powerful and compelling overarching identity that can draw all these elements together. This identity has to be more than just a job description. You can't expect taxi driver to cover all the components of what you hold dear. I know someone who'd been a drummer in a rock band that had almost made it. He gave up and became a dispatch rider. Instead of keeping up the drumming, he got rid of everything. He gave me his drum kit and tried to be as professional as possible, with matching leathers and a fancy BMW, showing a certain disdain for his former life. He was trying to integrate everything under a static definition, a mere job description. And sadly, as a dispatch rider, he was less successful than another who rode a battered bike, yet was lively and more likeable, and who self-identified with being a world traveller. The poet, photographer and businessman Ramsay Wood once told me that identifying as poet was much better than being just a writer. I wasn't sure why, but I know now. A poet, as an identity, vouches a greater connection to the mysterious and valuable. It is a higher level kind of identity. It is up to all of us to find a higher level identity. Something that connects and unites all our various elements. Something that stops one of our multiple selves murdering the others. Something that encourages the growth of all aspects of our personality. The kind of things you micromaster over time will give clues about which higher level identity is appropriate to you. Merely being aware of it will help you find an identity that works to integrate your life better. If you overdevelop strength of mind, you may end up despising others, a failure of empathetic development. If you overdevelop caring, you may end up stunting someone's ability to stand on their own feet, a failure of perception. But just because an overdevelopment of one aspect is so obviously grotesque, doesn't mean we can't try to work on developing all aspects. Glimpse your potential. Having a polymathic worldview might lead you to dabble in many things. Micromastery is the way to turn dabbling into a glimpse of your true and amazing potential. Micromastery is practical polymathy. It's a way to really achieve a dream of doing many things, your personal bucket list, like the wish lists of Clifford Pickover. It's also a great way into a subject you may eventually choose to master. I have seen people who would be classed as delinquent and incapable of learning anything new walk out of an Aikido dojo after a year with a black belt. They started by learning a single move, a micromastery. I've met people with little formal educational background who have studied a hard foreign language to fluency. They started by entering a language school to find out how to order a meal and a coffee, a micromastery. Micromastery is about regaining the permission to be interested and involved. In certain eras, this philosophy was embraced. How else do we explain the explosions of talent in the polymathic phases of history? Islamic Spain, Elizabethan England, Revolutionary America. Once people grasp that their task is to develop their potential in every direction, then the world becomes a better, brighter, more enlightened place. It is the very opposite of any form of narrow-minded fundamentalism that seeks to enslave people to further a worldview. In a small way, micromastery is the first step to becoming truly superhuman.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Micromastery: Learn Small, Learn Fast, and Find the Hidden Path to Happiness by Robert Twigger. This program was produced and directed by Sam Halstead. Text copyright 2017 by Robert Twigger. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Books, LTD. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.